Okay, so today we're going to be discussing the controversy over determining the time of death and the related issue of organ donation. That's probably the most controversial topic we'll hit all year. We hit a lot of controversial topics. I guess abortion's up there also. But women rabbis, yeah, there are a bunch of controversial topics we hit. But certainly, I still think within the Orthodox world today, at least within the internal amongst internal divisions, the issue over the time of death and brain death is particularly sensitive. The issue originates in many different, many different venues, but in theory, determining time of death should be an easy thing to do, right? There shouldn't be a modern controversy. Why shouldn't this be a modern controversy? Because people have always been dying. So then, you have to know when they die, right? Why do you have to know when they're dead? Halakhically speaking. Right? Why do you have to know if someone's dead?
Avela,
Tuma, Hilchot Shabbat, right? Aguno, Ghost. I mean, there are all sorts of issues that come up, halakhic issues related to knowing the status of a given person at a time, right? And forget about the emotional issues, right? Let's leave those aside for now, okay? So, not to belittle them, I'm just saying, but you know, on the legal level. So, in theory, this should be something which is well known and decided, and etc. It's not that simple. Why isn't that simple today? Or why was this historically not big of a deal? So we'll see. There were some controversies over this, but why was this historically not such a big fight?
Can preserve life longer,
right? There is historically, basically. Well, let's put it this way. Let's take a step back. Death is not a moment. Okay? Meaning on a scientific level, a medical level, death is not a moment. That's a process. Meaning, let's say, leave aside humans, right? When you take an example of the dysfunctioning of a given organism. So at what point do you say that a certain organism has ceased to function to the point where you say, oh, this is dead? Okay? Now, let's take an example. From a human or an animal, let's say a computer. When's my computer dead? Right. Well, I can describe the level of dysfunction that it has. It doesn't boot up properly, it's slow, it can't pull up certain files, etc., etc., right? But colloquially, obviously, we don't care about it so much, but just there's no legal implications. But when you call that dead, it's very hard to know. So, same thing with an organism, right? Let's take if an animal has certain bodily functions, which it does, and no longer performs a certain bodily function. Right? Does that make it dead? Performs other functions. Right. So, at what point do you say, though, that there's so many things that are dead, or one given thing that stopped work, that now this organism is dead? So, science can tell us a whole range of activities. The heart stopped working, stopped breathing, neurological process, all sorts of things going on. Right, and you could say that person's not dead until they start to decompose. You could make such an argument, right? I mean, in theory, why not? Okay, so no one does, but I'm trying to argue is that science can tell us that the process in which an organism stops to work, it's an ethical or religious or cultural or legal determination to say at what point in this process is that person dead. By the way, the truth is true for the beginning of life as well. We discussed this briefly with abortion, right? Whereas when do you say that this fetus, so there are different issues here. I mean, it might not be that it's alive is the critical factor. But one element of the debate over abortion is when do you say that you have a live organism, right, in the womb? Is it from conception? Right? Is it from 40 days, 3 months? Is it only from birth? Right? Now, you could also distinguish there and say, well, even if it's not a live organism, it has certain legal rights. Okay, but in theory, at least, so the same issue comes up. Science can't give you the answer to that question. In theory, you could argue and say, listen, a human being doesn't have, even if it's out of the womb, meaning it's born, doesn't have rights until it's a month old. Then it's really alive. Until then, we don't know. By the way, there are some halachic sources that discuss such notions as well. Okay, so it's a very important issue, right, that is only going to be determined on a legal level but not from a medical or scientific perspective. Now, it doesn't mean doctors shouldn't have input, I'm saying, but the ultimate answer is going to be a cultural phenomenon, which you find in different cultures today. There are different answers to this question. For that reason, by the way, in organ donation is not particularly exists, but it's a whole interesting story to it. But in Japan, for cultural reasons, if you quote unquote, right? So organ donation is not that popular precisely because of the fact that their understanding of when death is much later than necessarily made possible. We'll get into the details as we go along here. Okay. Now, that being said, historically, we can now determine and say, listen, the person's dysfunction is X, Y, and Z and has a process and lines that can be delineated and separated from each other. Historically, many times, not always, but many times, the person, you know, as the heart would stop functioning and the brain stopped functioning, et cetera, all, you know, sort of cascade one after another. And even if it wasn't happening that way, we didn't know it. Okay? With modern technology, you now have cardiopulmonary resuscitative techniques, right, which allow for the, even then, this says that even though spontaneous respiration has stopped, meaning a person has stopped breathing on their own, nonetheless, we can artificially prolong respiration that keeps the heart alive. So you can have a situation today, which is critical for our purposes, in which a person's heart is functioning perfectly fine, but only because there's a certain instrument, right, that is keeping air flowing, namely artificial respiration. And so you have a situation where you have irreversible damage to the part of the body that causes, right, a person to breathe spontaneously. And yet, because of artificial respiration, we can keep oxygen flowing, and therefore the heart is pumping just fine. Is that person dead or are they not dead? And then, of course, you know, there are all sorts of other different levels of debilitation, which we know, right? PVS, persistive vegetative state, right? People call it vegetable, as certain forms of dysfunction, and many other elements of dysfunction, which, as I'm sure you know, that there are ethicists out there, not particularly orthodox ones, but some of the ethicists out there in the world who would make an argument and say, listen, once a person is a vegetable, or once a person's in a comatose state for X number of years, whatever it might be, then we should no longer treat them because we have limited resources and we should use those resources in other directions. Okay? I'm not advocating such a position by any means, but I'm saying to you is that you shouldn't think that like people who make such claims are ki'ilu playing with the rules, as it were. Meaning they're basically making arguments saying we don't know when a person is dead on a scientific level. It's a legal or cultural determination. And we think for X, Y, and Z ethical arguments, right, it should be made at this point. It's not my position, but it's out there. Okay? So, obviously the difficulty of technology is one of the factors that makes this a big issue, I mean, the difficulties that technology has presented. Another factor which comes up, as I mentioned briefly and momentarily ago, is that the phenomenon of limited resources is a big deal. Meaning when you determine a person is dead, so that makes a big difference in terms of what medical resources you're going to allocate to a person. And you might argue and say, that, listen, a person who is, we'll define this momentarily, but who has a brainstem death, okay, which means that the nervous system has been damaged to the point where it will no longer allow for the lungs to produce oxygen or respirate on its own, right, spontaneously on its own, irreversible damage. You might say that such a person is not dead, but nonetheless, we shouldn't provide any medical resources because simply put, it's not worth spending our money when we could be spending money on someone who needs treatment for cancer. I don't know, whatever it might be. Okay, so that's one factor that certainly is a major factor that comes up in various, you know, elements of this debate. I'm not talking about this in the halakhic world as much as the broader world. And then, of course, the big factor is organ transplantation. Okay, now, this is only a relatively recent phenomenon, but the phenomenon works very simply. There are two different types of organ transplantations, right? One is from a live donor, which you only can do certain things, such as like a kidney. We can survive very well on one kidney. And therefore, if someone has a renal failure, a person can donate a kidney to someone else, and in theory, both of them should be able to live just fine on one kidney. Okay, my brother donated a kidney to my father after he had renal failure. Okay, and but it's a well-known phenomenon, right? That exists. Now, obviously, you can't donate your heart to someone when you're alive. Why not? Because you need a heart, right? And therefore, the second and more, you know, maybe it's more prominent element of this, with regard to, we'll discuss live donations next week. With regard to post, you know, after a person dies, donations, right? So there, hearts and other such organs, there the question now becomes very simple. If you wait until a person no longer, if you define death as saying that you require not only the cessation of respiration, but also the cessation of a heartbeat, then basically you are very much limited in the number of organs that you can donate. Now, A, donate, and B, just the time frame is much more limited as well. What's the reality? So you have, what usually this happens, when a person is 75, right, they're not donating their organs. Right? Just those organs aren't in the shape. Unfortunately, usually the situation is when organ donation comes up, is a situation of a person who dies tragically young, such as, let's say, a car accident, whatever it might be, but more or less their organs are in good shape, something else obviously was damaged, and you now are at the point where they have brainstem death, which means when it's done properly, this is one of the issues that comes up, is that not always have, there have been a number of studies in medical journals, a very prominent medical journals, a number, that not always are people sticking to the standards that have been determined. But let's say that the standards are properly followed, and the hospital does certain tests which determine that a person's brainstem, right, has been damaged to the point where their nervous system will no longer be able to allow the lungs to respirate on its own. Okay, now, but their heart and organs are just fine. Why are their hearts and organs just fine? Because they have them on an artificial respirator. So what happens when you have them on an artificial respirator? They got oxygen going. They got blood going. So these organs can now be used. How are they used? Well, basically, you have an organ transplant list, which is based on a number of factors. One of the critical factors is supposed to be anonymous. I mean, it's not based on protection or anything like this. It's supposed to be based on, and is, based on just medical criteria. How long have they been waiting for? How serious of a need is there? Et cetera, et cetera. And then you have a situation where, you know, basically they get called up. People usually who are waiting for organs have a beeper. They get called up and say, please come to the hospital. We are going to harvest an organ right now from someone who's dying. The family has agreed to donate the organs. Okay. Now, if you wait until the heart has stopped functioning, right? So the organs have there are fewer organs that can be taken at that point, and a much more limited time frame. Whereas if you define death as being at the brainstem death, which means that they will no longer be able to use their lungs will no longer be able to function spontaneously, right? At that point, then you can harvest, you know, up to 8 various organs, which is a big deal, right? A very big deal. Now, I don't think that the technology of organ transplantation wasn't relevant to how we define death. Meaning, as this technology becomes available, people start to rethink the question, oh, right, how should we define death? And there's this famous Harvard Medical School Committee in 1968, which then gets followed by a number of worldwide organizations that define brainstem death as the time of death. And in most countries around the world, this has been accepted as the legal time of death, which means you need to identify the cause to rule out potentially reversible causes, meaning you really need to make sure this is what's going on. You perform all tests to determine, right, that there's a total lack of response to the environment, that there's an absence of brainstem reflexes, which will lead to an absolute absence of spontaneous respiration. Okay, that's what you need. And there are various tests that have been developed along the line in order to determine this. Okay, now, let's be clear here. Okay, and it's very important because there's a lot of misinformation on this. There has never been a documented case in which a person who's been documented as having brainstem death, which means that their nervous system is no longer functioning to the point where they're able to have irreversible damage, right, to their respiratory system. There's never been a case of a person who's been properly documented as having this, who's quote-unquote come back to life. never happened. There have been many cases in which people have been misdiagnosed, right? And for one reason or another, because the hospital didn't do the proper testing or whatever various other factors, right? And therefore, they weren't really dead, meaning according to brainstem death. They were believed to have been brainstem death, and they just didn't. Okay? And this is one of the factors that goes on, which causes people to be very hesitant about donating organs, because there's like this great fear. What if, you know, my beloved, who has died tragically, and remember, these aren't cases where people have been waiting for 6-7 years for this to happen. You know, it's July 4th weekend, like for example, my father's waiting for it's an organ list, so he was always told, don't travel any national holiday in America. Why? Because every national holiday in America, people get drunk, and people get drunk, they drive, and then they die. Right? And those are good organs, which is very gruesome way of thinking about life and holidays, but that's the reality, okay? So, what happens? Someone dies, and then the social worker comes up and asks people and says, you know, like, would you be interested in it? It's a very traumatic moment, and of course, immediately the family says, well, maybe he's not really dead, right? So anyway, but there are properly tests that are done to be able to determine this, and then the question now becomes, right, once it's properly done, and Israel, by the way, there are all sorts of new protocols in order to encourage organ donation, we'll get to momentarily, to try to ensure that's properly done, but I don't want you to walk away from here feeling that medical healthcare practitioners are relaxed about this. There are cases of this, it's been documented, but by and large, you know, we shouldn't have a fear factor here. By and large, these things are done properly. And then the question now becomes, I'll take a question momentarily, the question now becomes is, does halacha recognize brainstem death as a time of death? Nafkamina, organ donation. It's a very clear situation. Can a Jew donate their organs? Well, if you accept death, if you define death as brainstem death, then at that point you should be allowed to donate organs. Why? And as in general, we say you're not allowed to mess around with people's bodies, the corpses, right? Nivel amet, it's a very serious issue. So why is this allowed in such a case? Why would it be allowed in this case? Pikuach nefesh, right? For sure. Pikuach nefesh docha nivel amet. Absolutely, no doubt about it. Have we discussed donating your body to science yet? So we'll come back to this as well. But in other words, leaving aside that's pikuach nefesh. Here it's absolute pikuach nefesh. And the other fact that comes up is, what about tchiyat hamitim? What's going to happen when tchiyat hamitim comes? What are they going to do? You just gave away your kidney. Right? So I hate to reveal a secret, but you know, after a while, when you're 6 feet under, that kidney, you know, isn't going to be, you know, doesn't stay whole 6 feet under, right? And I always tell people, if the Ribono Shel Olam has a way of doing tchiyat hamitim, you know, find a way as well to give you back your kidney, right? Or maybe you won't, no, not to worry about this. So the critical issue then becomes, do we accept this to be the time of death or not? Sorry, the question. Yeah.
So any medical test is not 100% accurate as right versus wrong.
Right.
So in determining brainstem death, and you've alluded, there's obviously errors.
Right.
You say if the test is done properly, what is the definition of a proper test? And where the result is reproducible 100% of the time.
So this is a obviously sensitive question. Truth is, one of the people that study this, there are two issues here. It's which test do we believe is determinative properly? And then what you're looking for is, originally they said there should be no movement in the brainstem. So it's clear the brain isn't, there's no activity there at all. That doesn't happen. Right? That doesn't happen for much longer. I mean, it happens eventually, but it doesn't happen for much longer time. And then they realize, well, that really shouldn't be the criteria. The criteria here should be, what's the amount of brainstem death, in other words, of damage, of limited activity, to the point where we feel now that will not cause any more a respiratory activity. And then how do we test for that? Right? Now, one of the things, my father actually, who's a professor of bioethics, wrote an influential article on this in the, must have been late, early 90s in JAMA, one of these, a journal, where he basically said, and note the fact, you look all around the United States, and not only with between different states, but even within the same state, even the same city, various hospitals are using different standards and different tests, of course, in order to figure out what this is. So what we need to, now, my father wasn't arguing against brainstem death, he was basically saying, we need to determine what the proper functioning should be, and then we should try to make this more uniform, so that way you have, you know, some form of uniform test. Now, interestingly enough, that study was brought to Shlomo Zalman Orbach, the great poskim of, you know, who died in the mid-90s, and it was shown to him and said, see, the doctors now claim that we don't really know that there's death because it's not true, there's still brainstem activity, there's still activity going on in the brain. Now, my father's argument had been something different. My father's argument was basically saying, we just need to find something to determine what is that critical point. And there are different disagreements about what the tests are and whatnot, and their various functions, and this still happens. And there's no uniformity today with regard to this, in various, within the states, around the world, for sure. Which is one of the issues that people bring up. But as I always tell people, you know, I don't think that there's this general... I fully say this, but I don't think that there's this general like desire for everyone to, you know, for people to grab organs as if it's like that. And people are willing to accept brainstem death, and the question is, you know, how to determine that. Which, like you said, you're correct, of course, it's better than I do. Right? Not every test works perfectly, and that's why you usually multiple tests as well in order to determine it. To check the circumstances and whatnot. Okay, so let's take a look at the sources here, and let's see what we come up with. Okay, now again, if we're looking now to figure out how halacha determines the time of death, so where are we going to look? Okay, so we've discussed previously one of the complexities of medical ethics and halacha is that basically you're going to use ancient sources that are talking about a very different reality and somehow try to apply it to contemporary reality and contemporary technology. We saw last week that with regard to euthanasia, so one of the comparisons is how do you compare removing a ventilator to the case in the Shulchan Aruch, which is that you're not allowed to stop, excuse me, you're allowed to stop a woodpecker, right, or a log chopper, right, from doing this stuff because that's keeping the person alive. Well, how does that relate to a modern respiratory machine? So obviously the analogies here are quite difficult to make, and we're going to look at other areas in where death seems to be critical, a factor in halachic matters, and then see how it gets applied. Yeah. Yeah.
Let's say you were able to tell brainstem death like for sure 100%.
Yeah.
Is there a distinction between donating to a non-Jew versus a Jew?
Oh, so this is a very interesting issue, but before, no. No, first of all, you can't make such distinctions, but just so you know.
Right.
The system doesn't allow it.
You can't designate your organs for a specific person.
That's right.
Right.
And the second thing is that halakhically, the answer is no. Why that is an interesting question, which relates to the larger issue of why Jews treat non-Jews in general, since the Gemara seems to say it's usher, especially on Shabbat.
Like that.
Correct, right? Correct. And that will be a future shear. But just to make things clear from the get-go, you absolutely do treat non-Jews at all times during the week, Shabbos, and when donating organs. Okay? Why that is, how we got to that conclusion, is a fascinating issue in the history of halacha, but we'll get to it. Okay. All right, so the Mishnah in Yomo, which is going to be a very important Mishnah for these factors, tells us as follows. V'chol safek nefasho dochet ha-Shabbat. We know as in general rule that not only is pikuach nefesh dochet ha-Shabbat, but even safek nefasho is dochet ha-Shabbat. This relates to next Mishnah comes up to your question here. Misha nafla alav mapolet. Safek u'sham, safek enu sham. We have the following situation. A person, there's been an avalanche, and we're mesupa, we're doubtful whether the person was there or not there. Or he was there, but Suffolk Chai, Suffolk Met. Or if it's Suffolk Ove Kochafim, Suffolk Yisrael, whether the person who's underneath the rocks is Jewish or non-Jewish. So if you have a Suffolk, what do? Mefachin alav et agal, motzi uchar mefach alav, ve'im me anichuhu. If you violate Shabbat, meaning you move the avalanche, do what it takes, right, in order to see if this person is alive. And if not, then he gets left there until after Shabbat. We'll leave that aside for now. Now, the implication is basically right now is that there are cases, times when we're doubtful. Now, how do we determine? All right, so you move the rocks. And now you got to figure out, is this person alive or dead? So the Gemara asks, Tanu Rabbanon, ad heichan hu bodek, until what point do you check? So at first, the Gemara says, give two answers. Ad chotmo, v'yeshomim ad libo. Do you check until his... What's a chotem? Nostrils. Or alternatively, do you check until the heart? Okay, now what are you looking there for? Okay? Now, by the way, it's interesting to take a look at the Yerushalmi, two sources down, four sources on the page, has a different version. It says either you check for the chotem, his nostrils, or you check ad tiburo. What's tiburo? the navel, right, the belly button. What are you checking that area for? To see if what? There's some form of movement, right? In this, in the Yerushalmi, what are you looking for in the Chotem? And you're looking in the Tiburo, what are you looking for?
Respiration.
Very clear in the Yerushalmi.
So why do you need both?
Well, the question is, which is a better indicator of seeing it? Now, the Gemara and the Bavli, let's go back 1 second, ask the same question here. It says, "Aval ina pikuach nefesh, afilo abba shu modi ikar the ikar chiyuta ba'afehu." Where do we see the element of the ikar, the fundamental sign of life, is in the nose? The pasuk that he brings is interesting. Dichtiv kol asher nishmat ruach chayim be'apav. Anyone who has what? Ruach Hayim in his nose. Amar of Papa, and therefore machloka mimata l'mala, ava mimala l'mata, kaven debodok le'ad chotmo, shuv enotzarech. When is a machloka? Do you look at the heart area, or do you look until the nostrils? Is only if you started the process from mimala l'mata. But kaven debodok, excuse me, mimata l'mata, from the feet up. There is, you stop at the heart, or do you go all the way to the nose? Avam emala lamata kevon debodok le'ad chotmo. But if you start looking at the nose, the body boulder has got removed off the body. It's from the head down. Once you get to the nostrils, that's enough. Shuv en hatzarech lechtiv kol asher nishmat ruach chayim be'apav. Now, what are you checking the nostrils for? Well, what's the test? Is let me do this. You know, like the do this. That test, right? Or you want to see the air conditioning's working, right? I mean, it seems like it's a very rudimentary way of saying. Basically, you're looking for, what does it seem clear from this Gemara? What are you looking for?
Respiration.
Right? Which may also be, take a look at Rashi here. Rashi, the second end of the Rashi here. Rashi says, Damarmar, bilibo yesh livchon, im yesh bochiyut, shenishmato dofeket sham. Umar amar, ad chotmo, dezimlin dein chut nikar bilibo, v'nikar bechotmo. Okay, now, when he says to look in the heart, what's he looking for?
Pulse.
Right? Well, it's interesting. There's the looking here for a pulse, right? There's a similar dofeket shab. Now, this is, there are those who say that based on here, you see there's just a machloket between the Amoraim about what do you care about? Do we care about respiration or do we care about circulation, right? Now, it has been argued, I think correctly, that both Chazal and Rashi were assuming ancient medieval understandings of the way that the body works, in which the heart and the respiration are very much intertwined with each other here. In which case, it's very much possible that even according to Rashi, what he really cares about, understands the heart to care about, is respiration. Or to know, but either way, at the end of it, you see there's an article by someone named Dr. Eddie Reichman, who writes a lot about of history of medicine and halacha. In any case, what it seems to be is that the maskana of the Gemara is, what do we care about? Respiration. Okay? And the Shulchan Aruch brings us down to halacha that we check the nostrils for respiration. Now, there's another interesting element here. Another interesting factor that comes up in the Mishnah and Ohalot. The Mishnah and Ohalot is dealing with issues of Tumah and Tahara. And the Mishnah tells us that Hutzo Roshayam, what happens if an animal, which also has Tumah and Tahara related to it, what happens if an animal is decapitated? So if the animal gets decapitated, Afa Pi Shemifachasimim to man, to go Zanav Shalata, Shemifachasim. It becomes Matame, even though the body is still moving. Why is the body still moving in the animal?
Reflux,
spasms, right, etc. Right.
Chicken.
I'm sorry. If you ever that chicken, etc. Right. If you've ever been either high school kid with a BB gun, or alternatively, if ever YouTube like Shchita. I grew up in Texas. Okay. Right. Or I grew up, you know, or Chataini Maskir Hayom. Anyway, but or if you ever gone to YouTube and seen like, you know, Pita's videos of Shchita, and you see like the bodies moving all over the place of these animals. Okay. There's but. Chazal understood this phenomenon and said, if it's decapitated, the animal's dead. That's the way it works. Okay, now the question becomes also, these are two of the major sources that are relevant here, and you should know that the issue of not always knowing when a person is dead is not a new phenomenon. Okay, And there are two interesting examples that come from the sources. The first is the second the bottom source on the bottom page, number one, which talks about the following tragic situation. A woman is in labor, and Chalila, she dies in labor, and it's Shabbat. So what do? You cesarean section, cut open, or save the baby. Now, the Gemara and Shulchan Aruch bring down, at such a situation, we violate the Shabbat, we bring the knives, whatever it might be, through Rosh Hashanah, etc., in order to save the baby. And then the Ramah adds, Ramah's writing in 16th century Poland, and says, "Umasha anu agi machshav ken afilu b'chol, mishum de'em b'kiyem b'mitat de'em b'karav kokach shavshar levla l'chiyot." He brings down Masorah from 100 years beforehand, which basically says that in his time, they didn't do a C-section. Why not? Because they were never too sure if the woman was really dead. They were uncertain about the signs of death. And therefore, by the time they were felt confident enough, most times they would open up the womb and the fetus had already died. Okay? So you see one interesting historical source which talks about the fact that people aren't always so confident about time of death. Right? This is not, and obviously fainting, you know, their coma, you know, all sorts of phenomena can lead to such a situation. The most interesting and particularly pertinent issue for our purposes is the incident that happened in 19th century Europe. Have you ever heard of the expression "saved by the bell"? Yeah. Okay, what's that about?
Boxing.
No, not boxing. Not boxing and not school and not the TV show, but... you'll YouTube this or you'll Google this and you'll find out that Saved by the Bell had a following phenomenon. In the early to mid 19th century...
Wait, is this the same thing as For Whom the Bell Tolls?
For Whom the Bell Tolls?
I know they had like, what was an expression, but they didn't know someone was dead, or they have bells like a set of graves.
I thought it was, yes, this is a phenomenon, but I thought it was Saved by the Bell.
Oh, right.
Is that from Bill Tolles? Maybe I got confused.
Okay, this is a phenomenon.
You'll Google it afterwards and you'll figure this out. Maybe I got confused. But in any case, the following phenomenon happened in early 19th century Europe, where there are all sorts of phenomenal stories being published in the papers and causing mass widespread fear of people being buried alive, who had fainted or other phenomenon, they're believed to be dead, and all of a sudden, you know, they get, they're in the morgue or they're being buried and pitom, you know, they just wake up and start screaming. Okay? And therefore, there's a whole industry of people being buried with their arms up, holding the bells, so that way, if they're 6 feet under, and, or probably less actually then, and they wake up, what do? Ring the bells. I thought it was Saved by the Bell, but maybe it's from the book. All right, anyways. No, if not from the bell tolls. We'll Google this afterwards. Any case, this is going to bother me all day until I figure this out, but leave that aside. Okay, so this is a whole phenomenon. And now the question becomes, what do you do about this? So the governments of 19th century Europe have a very simple solution, namely, don't bury people right away. And let the body wait 3-4 days until whatever think they're dead, until you see signs of decomposition, at which point, then you can bury them. Okay? So this is going on. And this was the governmental decree. What's the problem for a Jew?
It's going to smell.
It's going to smell, yes. But besides that, right? There's an Isser known as Halamat Metin. You should not delay the burial, right? Which is a, according to most, at least one Isser Deraisa, maybe a second, according to the Ramban, right? And that's a very big issue. We have a generally speaking, we don't delay burials. That's why in Yerushalayim, they're very machbid, right? To do funerals very quickly. There is a notion of delaying burial, l'chvod ha-met, for the sake of the met, right? On the met, so relatives can come, preparations can be made, etc. But as a general rule, we don't unnecessarily delay burials, right? There's this whole phenomenon of like Hollywood stars, like, you know, die, and then like a week later, like the, you know, just for whatever reason, you know, they don't. That's not a halachically acceptable concept unless there's some form of reason for it to be done. So this is the issue gets brought to the poskim, and there's a very fascinating tshuva from the Chatam Sofer, very important type of page on the tshuva. Who's the Chatam Sofer? Rav Moshe Sofer, right? The greatest, probably greatest posek of the early 19th century, certainly Ashkenazic posek, right? A Hungarian, very, very, very influential, sort of seen as the forefather of ultra-Orthodoxy, although I don't think it's really a fair categorization in many ways, and very famous for being one of the adamant opponents of the Reform movement. Okay, so anyway, so the issue gets brought up to him, and he's very much against the notion of delaying burial. He says, absolutely not. And look what he says. Al korchach, he says, faz. Us and tapishim to the bold. As nimsar lanu shir mita ulaya as misor malei tivim rishonim apish nishkach brofes vanenu. Maybe historically we had some form of mesora of knowledge of when death is that was acquired from, you know, doctors or scientists or it might be, which is lost today. Maybe there's a Mesorah of Alach L'Moshe M'Sinai, or they just simply looked at the Pasuk of Asheru Chaim, etc., etc. But it's clear that what is the factor, the determinant, the criterion for death in Halacha? Respiration. And if a person has stopped breathing, then they're dead. Okay? And he's very much adamant about this. He says, listen, this is not a new phenomenon. There have been other times when people have fainted, other sorts of ambiguities that go about. We don't know, but at the end of the day, we halachically paskin that people are dead. Right? And this absolute fear, right? Look at the next bowl. After you wait a little bit, you've now lost the fear of fainting. We don't wait to see some forms of signs of decomposition. And therefore, until this point, it seems very clear the Chatam Sofer is saying what? What is the sole criterion for death in Halacha? Breathing. Okay. Now, there is one interesting line he throws at the end here. But after we see that person is resting like an Evan Domem, like a rock, and he has no pulse. What's he add here? Interestingly enough here. He also mentions not only right breathing, but he's also concerned about a heartbeat. Okay? Which he sort of throws in there. Now, what do we get from this tshuva? So I think if you read this tshuva, it's very clear the Chatam Sofer is saying what? There's one sole criterion. What is the sole criterion? Respiration. Ah, why did he throw in there the phenomenon of a pulse? Because in his time period, if anyone had a pulse, there's obviously some form of breathing going on. But he wasn't coming to say, if you happen to put on a very expensive, sophisticated machine, which allows the person to breathe, right? Therefore, we care about the heartbeat. But there are those who say, no, it's clear from this Chatam Sofer that as long as one of these three things is happening, either a person is moving, or there's some form of respiration, or there's a heartbeat, then the person is not dead. I think that's a forced read, but well, not. In any case, the other citation here, another important tshuva, comes up in the Marsham. Marsham is an important posek towards the end of 19th century, early 20th century, and he discusses the following situation. There's a person in a morgue, and he was hearing all sorts of weird sounds coming from a body. And he wanted to know, do we bury this person or not? Now, not to be ruin your appetite, but as a general rule, I haven't been there, but I've been read and been told, that bodies do emerge from corpses. That's because of, sounds do emerge from corpses. Right? Bodies don't emerge, right? Yeah. Watching too many horror films, right? Sounds do emerge from corpses. This is because of gases being released and other phenomenon. But the person in the morgue was hearing unusual sounds. And the Marsham said, listen, the nose, the respiration, is what we care about as long as everything else is normal. But if there are other signs of life, then we should treat this person as alive. Now, what do you do with that? Well, you could argue and say, if there's other... There's, what is he basically saying? What you might interpret the Marsham to mean is as follows. When did the Gemara say that respiration is the criterion for death is only in the absence of any signs of life. But if there are other signs of life, such as a heart beating, right, then they're alive halachically. Now, the response back to that is, no, you cannot create a compare a situation that the Marsham's talking about of signs of life, which indicate to us, oh, something else is going on inside the body, to a situation of contemporary technology in which we can know very well, or to a large extent, what's going on in that body. And we know that the reason why the heart is beating is simply because we've attached it to a respirator. So, what happens in the poskim? So, if you take a look on page number 3, you'll see a number of poskim, like the Tzitz Eliezer, like the Shevet HaLevi, Rav Osner, Rav Waldenberg, and others, were very much adamant in saying, as long as there is some form of bodily function, which we see, right, recognize, right, then this person is alive. And therefore, you cannot treat the person as being dead, which means you cannot open up their body and harvest the organs. And if you do, you're a murderer. Okay? Now, it's not first-degree murder because they're ghosts or whatever, but you're basically, as the Tzitz Eliezer says, Ye yatsa shemamash horgim nefashot. That is definitely one position which is very much out there. Rav Eliezer of Waldenberg, the Shevet HaLevi, Rav Osner, and others who very much say, listen, you can't donate organs. Now, what's interesting is it's a little bit of a problem. You see, the problem is that, for that, what's the definition of death there? So the definition of death becomes cardiopulmonary. And it's basically you're saying that you have both. You care about both respiration as well as a heartbeat. Now, according to that logic, someone said to me once, well, if you take a dead person and you perform some form of CPR, right, or, you know, pump, so you can cause blood to move, does that make them alive? And the question is what this definition really is, and at what point we say someone's dead. And their response is that issue, challenge. In other words, are they really giving us here a finite criterion saying there's a moment of death or not? In any case, there are a number of poskim who very much feel that organ donation is usser. What about receiving organs? So this is a great scandal, which don't tell the Guardian or any of the other Jew-loving newspapers around the world about, but the most poskim, almost all poskim, who think that you cannot donate an organ, believe that you can receive an organ. You know, this causes a certain amount of discomfort, right? There was a big issue in England. Who's from England here? Anyone's from England? Right? Remember this a couple years ago? The chief rabbi of England follows the psak of the London Beis Din. The London Beis Din went to Rav Yoshev on this issue, and Rav Yoshev felt that it's a suffix. So this is Rav Shechter's opinion as well, and therefore it's a suffix, they're dead. So therefore a Kohen can't enter the room of someone who has brainstem death, right? Because they're maybe they're dead, right? Maybe they're macabre, have tumah, but you cannot harvest the organs. But the London Beis Din, based on Rav Yoshev and other psakim, do feel that you are allowed to receive organs. Now, this wind of this whole issue got to the newspapers in London, the journalists in London, and this caused a bit of a scandal, where there are those who accuse the chief rabbi of basically saying that Jewish blood, Gentile blood, is not worth as much to him as Jewish blood. This is not a fear. Let me say something about this. I very much think it is very problematic to say that you can take but not give. I think it's very problematic. Meaning, if you believe that this is the ethical criterion for determining death, you should be consistent. And you shouldn't be supporting such a... I know the argument's back. The argument's back by saying, well, it's not you, it's the doctors. And if we don't take the organs, someone else will take the organs, whatever it might be. So you can allow the person to live. I had one friend of mine who's not a believer in more brain death. And wrote to me, said, Miles, do you really want that 2-year-old who needs the organ to die? So what are you giving us a hard time about? I spoke back to him. That's not how you live an ethical life. We live an ethical life based on making principles and saying, this person is alive, this person is dead, and if you think that person is not dead, you should not be benefiting from a society which harvests their organs of alive, live people. I think it's horrible. I think it's a horrible phenomenon, but what can I tell you? For various reasons, the vast majority of poskim who say that you cannot donate believe that you can receive. So we've discussed the position of the Shevet Levi and Tzitzit Eliezer, we mentioned Rebbe Yoshev and Rav Shechter, and then there are positions of the Matirim. The Matirim are most explicitly include the chief rabbin of Israel, which in 1986 ruled that you can't brainstem death is the criterion for death. And therefore, once that has been determined, a person can donate their organs. They did this based on a tshuva, largely based on a tshuva that was written by Rav Moshe Feinstein. Now, Rav Moshe Feinstein's position is rife with controversy. Okay, and there are a number in the early tshuvas. It's very clear Rav Moshe thinks that heart transplants is usher, is double murder, right? It's both side directions. He thinks this is terrible, and he absolutely thought it was forbidden. As the technology advanced, both in determining death and in the success rate of these transplants, he was pursued on this issue by his son-in-law, Rabbi Tendler, right? Rabbi was also a biologist at YU. And based on the tshuva which you see here on the top bottom page number 2, top page number 3, which Rav Tendler, as well as the other children of Rav Moshe Feinstein, insist is his authentic final position. Rav Moshe felt that brainstem death is the criterion for death. And based on that, now there are those who allege that this is not the position of Rav Moshe, and there's a whole fight over this issue. I won't get into the politics of the matter right now, but based on their various Rosh Yeshiva that don't talk to each other because of the disagreements about what Rav Moshe said, and it's been quite fierce. In any case, based on this tshuva of Rav Moshe, but not only, but based on also what they think is the compelling argument, the chief rabbi of Israel, which at the time included Rav Avraham Shapiro Zatzal, and Rav Mordechai Eliyahu, and Rav Shaul Yisraeli, and others feel this way as well, believe that organ transplants are mutar, because they believe that brainstem death is the halachic criterion for death. Now, Israel has a terrible track record historically about donors. And part of the reason for this is that even chilonim, when it comes time to death, become very religious, quote unquote, and they believe that the religious position, for various reasons, is that a person should not donate their organs. And that's one factor. And the second factor is that there's an ongoing, which has been partially resolved, but ongoing fight between the rabbinic establishment and the medical societies over who should have responsibility for safeguarding and determining when brainstem death has really occurred. And should there be committees and overseeing and rabbis, et cetera, being involved in this process. And this is an ongoing fight to which there is an attempt to resolve this issue with legislation that was passed a few years ago. It was meant to sort of streamline the process and make sure proper safeguards are included to make sure that brainstem death is really a halachic death, which has helped encourage organ donation. Israel also did something very interesting, which is a pioneering thing around the world. Remember, I told you that in order to get an organ, there's no advantages. It's all medical criteria. Well, Israel passed a law which said that if you are a registered organ donor, then you or your family members get priority on the list. Meaning, it's one of the factors that goes into it. And that led a huge number of people signing up to a Kartis Edi, which is a Kartis here, whatever it might be. That is what allows people to say that they will donate their organs. I happen to be a very, very, very big believer in the fact that death occurs at respiration. I think it's like Mar Yuma says. I think it's the Pasuk of the Chasam Sofer. And therefore, and let's just think about it. No one who has ever had a situation of brainstem death has ever come back to be alive. So I agree. You have to properly check, and you should make sure that proper tests are done. But that being the case, I am very much a big believer in the fact that people should sign organ donor cards. and family members when the moment of truth comes, which, like I said to you, is always a tragic moment, should donate organs once they have ascertained and believe that proper testing has been done. I'm a very much a big believer in it. I feel it's a tremendous mitzvah, and yesh al-mali smoch in terms of various poskim who have this position. There's certainly others much greater than me who disagree on this issue, and I'm fully willing to admit that and agree with that. Elu ve'elu. But when people ask me, should I sign a donor card, I say yes. Now in Israel, you have a phenomenon where you can put on the back of your donor card, upon approval with supervision of a religious representative, which I checked. But, you know, in Chutz La'aretz as well, there's this feel, and this has been documented as well, that people who sign organ donor cards die faster. Okay? And this is a phenomenon which definitely exists. And don't think the doctor, you're a doctor, right? Don't think that doctors, I'm not saying it's just because you're here, don't think that doctors are like bloodthirsty and trying to like grab people's organs, right? Doctors are people who sit there day in, day out, and see thousands upon thousands of their patients die for no reason. And they die simply because there's a shortage of organs that have been donated. So I can understand why people in the medical profession are very much encouraging of organ donation. I think that's a very good reason to donate organs. Now, at the same time, I think it's very, very important. And I'm sure you saw that there's a whole scandal a couple of weeks ago in Europe, and it comes up all the time of, you know, improper testing done for people being dead. And that's a serious issue, and the medical profession should be more careful about it, and people should be more, you know, up, you know, on top of this. And which is why, you know, if the moment of truth comes, I think it's important to consult various members of the community of medical professionals or whatnot, or ethicists or rabbis who, you know something about the topic. But that being said, if Chalila, the moment of truth comes, I very much feel people should donate organs. And if you don't, I think people have to think long and hard about whether they think it is appropriate to accept organs if you're not willing to donate them, which I think is just horrific. I think it's horrific. And I've gotten orally Rav Aaron Lichtenstein to agree to me that that is the case. He's put this in print as well. Lichtenstein's own position on organ donation is... When he gets asked about it, a lot of times he just lays out the positions and tells people these are the various halachic positions and whatnot. I know certain cases like that, and I've asked him to write about the topic. I've spoken about it a number of times where he said to me he recognizes this is very problematic, but I wait till his written response on the issue. So I don't know. I'm not saying Rav Aaron Lichtenstein said this. I'm telling you that I feel comfortable saying that Rav Aaron Lichtenstein agrees that this is a morally problematic. What to do about that is a different issue. Right? Sometimes the chief rabbi's response was basically says, chief rabbi of England referring to you, they said, listen, different various members of society, every member of society contribute different phenomenon and different resources, and Jews can't donate this resource, but we donate other resources. Which, you know, I hear. I don't find compelling at all. Meaning that this is not a resource, that there's unlimited resources around. This is not, this is a resource where if everyone pitches in, and, you know, you take, you give, et cetera, the thing, then we save a lot of lives. Okay, I'll pull in here.